My name is Peter Bleakley. I'm a British Latter-day Saint, and I'm going to be talking today for about half an hour about kind of the journey I've been on. In a way, you could summarize it as a journey from being a sort of apologist for the church, in a sense, to becoming a loyal opposition or a friendly critic. And that has stepped up recently with a podcast series I've just started called Christians versus Pharisees, Choosing Sides in the Mormon Civil War and How to Fight for Them. And it's obviously putting my head above the parapet, you could say, and has consequences. But what I'm going to do today is kind of talk about how I got there and what kind of a space I'm trying to stake out or protect within the Latter-day Saint community. My Mormon story really begins with my great-grandmother, Jeannie Simpson, who became Jeannie Bleakley, and she was converted to Mormonism in the 1920s. And she was invited by some missionaries to go and hear James Talmage, the apostle, speak. And at the time, he was acting president of the British Mission. And he really impressed her. And she basically said, "I believe anything that man said." She joined the church. She was doing the British Empire bit, so then went home and spent the next several decades living in Ceylon and was the only Mormon there. And she was supported in her faith, particularly with correspondence with John A. Widsoe and his wife Leah, who were very kind and generous towards her. Somewhat, I think, the Browns, Hugh B. Brown, who was president of the British Mission. She'd occasionally come home to visit Britain and feel that connection with the saints in Britain. And the Mormonism that she responded to was very pro-science. Talmage and these other great thinkers were scientists, they were intellectuals, they were academics. And that was the Mormonism that she connected with. Very hopeful, very positive about the future, unafraid of where the world was going, seeing Mormonism as part of the development of the modern world. My parents, her grandson, David, my dad, and my mum, Shirley, who was a convert to the church, met at Brigham Young University in Provo. And the British Saints students hung out there. They met each other, got married, had me. So I was born in Provo and came back to Britain when I was about 1.5. While they were there, they were good friends with Dave Irwin, who's now the London Temple president. So when I keep joking that he was nearly the David who was my dad, which would have been fabulous. But anyway, I'm very happy with the one I got. And when they came back to Britain, they came eventually to Tunbridge Wells branch in Kent in Southeast England. Tiny little branch meeting in like the scuzziest rented community center ever in history. A little group struggling on, all British converts, occasionally an American would come and move in. And as they arrived, the response to them announcing they'd just kind of come from BYU was, "Oh good, we need a new branch president." And my parents were in leadership from that point onwards. And they were very much part of what we sometimes call the sacrificial generation. During the 60s and 1970s and into the 80s, these faithful Latter-day Saints just working constantly to build the church, to preserve these tiny little twigs and eventually, hopefully, have them spark up into becoming a ward and making that progress. And the advantage that my parents had was that they'd been at Brigham Young University for several years. So they had a vision of what the church could be, what it could become. And so they were able to kind of contribute that and do their little bit with all the others working hard to bring about this kind of creation of the church in Britain after we had basically been rebooted when most of the early converts of the 1800s and since just went to America. So we were kind of beginning from scratch during that time. And my life has kind of followed that trajectory in really interesting ways as I reflect on it. A lot of those people burnt out. At the time, church demanded all of your time. It was midweek, it was primary, was during the week in someone's house. You had several meetings on a Sunday. It was an intense, immersive experience of being in a very close-knit but demanding community. And leaders, particularly men, were often away from the home. The mindset that I grew up with in what Mormonism is, what our role in it is, was absolutely crucial, I've realized, to me surviving challenges since. It was always this idea that the church is our responsibility. We make it. We love it. We are faithful to it. But sort of lunchtime on a Sunday was always then a massive critical analysis of, right, what went wrong today? And how are we going to fix it? So I grew up with it being normal to constantly consider we are on a journey. We need to do better. Whatever didn't work today, what can we do to sort that out and do better tomorrow? And that worked with the Mormonism we were being taught religiously, that we're all on a journey of progression and improvement. And so that idea of having constant analysis of things not being perfect, but that's okay, we're on a journey, was really foundational to the upbringing I had in the church. And it meant I was able to differentiate between choices by leaders and what the real religion is, if you see what I mean, which turned out to be very helpful later. I was a real nerdy, very shy, sort of intellectual geek type. At that time, there was still a Church of England culture in the country. It was dying fast, but it was kind of there. And we were very conscious of being a persecuted people, or at least a misunderstood people. The way we lived was very different to the normal culture, which all revolved around the pub. And as a teenager, all my friends were about, you know, boozing and all of that and drugs. And that just wasn't what we did. So our experience was very much being outsiders, having to really be sure of why you're doing this. Why are you bothering? What is your religion? You couldn't just remain active in the church without thinking about it. You need to really have a reason to be going and to fight for it and make that stand, which in a way meant that our teenage rebellion, rather than being channeled in rebellion against church and gospel values, as it were, that by being an enthusiastic Latter-day Saint with its values, you were badass. You were being quite countercultural, you know. And there was an exhilaration about that in some ways. I was very conscious then of our place as Mormons in a larger, particularly Christian world. I got involved in the Christian Union at my secondary school and met for the first time and really interacted with just lovely British Christians, you know, this rare species, hardly any of either of us left, and started getting into discussing and understanding deep doctrines. With my peers at church, had some great young men and women I was growing up with, and we loved all this stuff. We constantly talked about Mormon doctrine. We had the book Mormon Doctrine, had all the answers in it. Our parents had the journals of discourses on the shelf. This was the sort of not very correlated Mormonism of the past, where all kinds of wild ideas were going around. I decided to serve a mission. I was reaching Fowler's stage 3, so I was certain it all makes sense. I wasn't particularly spiritual, but the gospel had always made sense intellectually. And just as I came up serving my mission, I really started to have more spiritual experiences and kind of be like, oh, so that's what that is. Okay. And I kind of didn't need them till then. I was just very worked things out in my head, I suppose. I got called to the Florida Tallahassee mission in the Bible Belt, which was North Florida, South Alabama, and one county each of Mississippi and Georgia, just to make it more southern. And it was a culture shock, and I loved it. It was incredible, crazy, racist, segregated. We'd just come out of South Africa getting over apartheid, and here I was going to go and live in America's apartheid South. And it was an incredible sort of experience from a sort of historical and social political point of view. I got involved in art projects. I'm an artist, so I ended up painting two huge murals in local schools, which was great, sort of a way to build up friendliness with the church in the area. One of the areas I served in, they hadn't told me this, but the previous missionaries got run out of town at gunpoint by a Pentecostal preacher. So, you know, we were building bridges and had a wonderful time there and experienced for the first time living in a completely Christian culture and all its dysfunctions, and very excited about how we'd kind of fixed a lot of that stuff. You know, if you imagine the worst televangelists, multiply it by 10, and that's what's going on every corner, that's the Deep South evangelical religion for you in many ways. The experience of the Provo MTC was an interesting one, in part because a mission president who'd served in our mission and had been pushing his missionaries with the numbers game to just baptize like machines and not really care much about if people were converted, followed on from the baseball baptisms to fill up our ward lists with dead wood, basically, that were a huge burden. And guess who the MTC president was? It was him. And I was like, you are kidding me. The lunatic's taken over the asylum. But then I was like, no, he's safe here. There's no actual people being taught. It's great. And he's a great motivator. So that was interesting. But from that, I'm already seeing kind of this idea of dysfunctions of how things are run, how power is gained or exercised in the church, and thinking about it all. Just at the end of my mission, I discovered Sunstone magazine. I think I may have heard of it before my mission, I don't know. It was this sort of word in the ether, Sunstone, shh, naughty. I was staying with a friend after my mission and went into Logan Library, and there are all these Sunstones on the shelf. And I went mental with their photocopier. This is all before the internet. And brought home loads of articles and subscribed. And suddenly I was connected with this world I had no idea existed of free thought and discussion about our church from a cultural perspective, political, critical analysis. And that became my lifeline, really, to kind of feed my brain as a Latter-day Saint from then on. I went to university in Chichester doing an art and related arts degree and got very involved in the Christian Union there. And it was fascinating. This was a time where the British evangelicals were getting super excited about what they called the Toronto Blessing, which was a kind of manifestation of extreme speaking in tongues and miracles. And they felt this was going to be the new Christian revival, a bit like the Wesleyan revival of the 1700s or 1800s that had converted Wales, you know, and they were super excited. So it was fascinating to see the best, the absolute best of young Christians in other churches champing at the bit to convert their country. And I learned a lot from it. First of all, I learned they need manuals. These people were totally disorganized. They were constantly reinventing the wheel. They wasted so much energy just deciding how to do church this week. And for the first time I realized, I actually appreciated that these things that seem a bit imprisoning, our manuals, our handbook, are actually a huge strength because anyone can pick them up and function. And I was seeing that all this energy, but really not achieving much because they just didn't have structure. So that was an interesting insight then. I learned that our religious deep stuff rocks. I had conversations with people there who are from Eastern religious traditions. And I was able to hold my own because of DNC 93, which is all about the philosophy of truth and light and the nature of intelligence. So I started to appreciate that our weirder stuff actually gives us a connection with the other world religions in ways that we don't usually appreciate within the Christian realm. And particularly the most profound and life-changing experience was my engagement with Steve, who was from a home. His parents ran a home church, evangelical, amazing, super spiritual, thoughtful, sincere, intense Christian, an art student a year above me. He was on the leadership committee of the Christian Union, and he was also the assistant to the Anglican chaplain on the campus. And after a year or so, an anti-cult campaigner did the tour of the local churches. And the Pentecostal other leaders of the Christian Union decided I was dangerous and asked me not to pray in meetings anymore. And I was really upset by this because I'd loved having that connection and I'd always been involved in Christian Union at school. Steve was upset by this as well because he was like, we're not a church, you can't excommunicate people. And this began Steve getting hold of every anti-Mormon book he could find anywhere ever, boxes of them, and investigating. Can we really say Peter is not a Christian? And we engaged then in 2 years of hours-long conversations and dialogue. And this is what I've been preparing for. I didn't need any of this in the Bible Belt, but this is where all my nerdiness as a teenager kicked in. My salvation was the truth about the God makers, which was kind of the only resource to refute a lot of the anti-Mormon criticisms. Got it here somewhere. Again, before the internet, which kind of evolved eventually into Fair Mormon. And just discussing our weird stuff, just on all the difficult topics the anti-Mormon literature could come up with, we were discovering together how Mormonism has things to say about stuff that leaves a lot of mainstream Christianity behind. And Steve was really powerfully kind of intrigued by this. Then one weekend I got back and found him asleep on his sofa with his Book of Mormon with notes all over it, asleep, took a photo. And then later on, he's like, "Do you know what's in this book, Peter?" And I was like, "Yes, Steve, I've been telling you for 2 years, you numpty." And he finally read the book, and that was it. He was converted. He suffered a lot for that. His family kicked him out. He ended up going on a mission to Ireland after I baptized him, which is possibly even worse than being evicted by your parents. That relationship healed later, though, which is lovely. His parents are lovely. But what that again taught me is how much treasure we have in Mormonism. Our doctrine is incredible. This was a peak moment. Everything was going great. Mormonism wins. I can convert the most amazing Christians you can throw at me, or rather God can and our ideas can. Our religion had become more welcoming. We stopped being racist, which was helpful. And our culture was welcoming. We could go to a youth convention and bring your non-member friends. And as long as they're not naked, it's great. And we have a good time and we can convert them. And we can be ourselves while being Mormons was really the major message we were getting, that you can do both. You can have a win-win. You can have your own culture, your own clothing, your own teen culture. But over time, I also started to become aware of some of the dysfunctions we have that we needed to work on. I was starting to see how much professionals, adults who function in their workplace as managers and leaders were infantilized at church, limited in what they're allowed to say and do, constantly nervous about, can I actually do this idea? Silence when they needed to say, no, this plan we've heard 20 times before for doing missionary work or reactivating people doesn't work. It didn't work all the other times. It's not going to work. Shall we try something that might work? But no, that was shamed into silence. And over again, we just wasted time repeating the strategies that don't work. So that was an issue. The constant baptizing people too quickly without giving them time. My mum took 6 months to join the church and she's been amazing. Her flatmate had to keep dragging the missionaries back. And the mission machine was only interested in people who never question anything, who just say yes quickly and will jump in a font. Occasionally missionaries would rebel and say, no, I'm working, I'm continuing. But nearly all the time their leaders and trainers were saying, don't bother with those people. They're not the elect, which is insane. So we filled our membership up with deadwood, people who weren't really converted or didn't know what they were doing, instead of taking the time to be the guide at the side of the people who would have been the keepers. The shaming we do of our children over normal experiences of puberty, that every young person, if they're honest in their interviews, gets locked into a shaming cycle, which is a cult control tactic to do with just being a human being with genitals. No common consent accountability, just always at the mercy of whatever 15 men think is God's will, without any filtering. Hostility to science. This science-friendly religion my ancestors embraced started to kick in. The September 6th intellectuals were excommunicated. Boyd K. Packer announced the enemies of the church are the intellectuals, the feminists, the homosexuals. I was an intellectual. My mum's a feminist. She was secretly subscribing to Exponent 2. She's so woke. While being State Relief Society president. My gay friends were, and who I'd served with on my mission, eventually had to drop out of church because it was not safe to stay. I have a list called Gays of Our Lives. It has about 20 people on it. People I grew up with, served missions with, taught as youth leader, people I've served in bishoprics and things with. All of them, except two or three, had to leave the church because it was not safe for them to stay. The church not dealing with evolution, still teaching in seminary that the world is 6,000 years old, which was a deal breaker for the brightest young man I ever taught in primary. That was one of the triggers for him to realize this place doesn't have truth, what's going on. there began to be a few steps forward, but I started to experience this kind of temporary golden age or flourishing of the religion going backwards. Multiculturalism was embraced. We had that enzyme with all the different races lined up, a bit like a Norman Rockwell illustration. Gordon B. Hinckley got a grip and said, we need to get back to basics doctrinally. We need to stop going off on these obscure flights of fancy. Let's focus on Christ, which was helpful just to rein in some of the extremes. Although in doing that, they ended up losing a lot as well, I think. We had the Mormon moments around Mitt Romney's presidential run, which triggered one of the greatest moments of my life in 2012, when the church, through President Newsroom, who knows who that is, but bless him. If it's you, Elder Otterson, we love you. Thank you. Disavowing racism, all racism in the church, past and present, which meant a lot to me after serving in the Deep South. And then the Gospel Topics essays, and then Rough Stone Rolling, you know, true history coming through now. But with the difficult acknowledgement that all the stuff the anti-Mormons used to accuse us of, 80% of it was actually spot on all along, which the church is still not prepared to acknowledge entirely. The homophobia became entrenched, Prop 8, the family proclamation, and then the 2015 policy of exclusion in November 2015, barring any babies, children, teenagers who had a parent who had ever cohabited homosexually in its original wording in the handbook, were not going to be allowed to be baptized or named and blessed or set foot in our temple and contaminate it until they were an adult, moved out of their parents' home, disavowed their parents' relationship, and then begged the First Presidency to be baptized. I think that was the moment that broke a lot of us, because it contradicts nearly all of the things Jesus taught. It contradicts the articles of faith about not being punished for your parents' transgressions. And just where until then, our attitude had always been, doesn't matter what your home life is like, we'll love you. Come and be Mormon. You're one of us. We will look after you. We'll compensate for whatever you might be lacking at home. And it was horrific. And then individual incidents of cruelty and lies. Elder Oakes and Ballard's face to face. Elder Ballard cheered me up. He'd said to the CES, we've got to teach true history. You've got to stop lying to the kids. Stop just telling them faith promoting stories. Know the gospel topics like the back of your hand and teach them. But a year or two later, when it was his turn to step up in front of the youth of the whole church in his face to face, he lied. He did everything he told them not to. He bore his testimony at them. He swore to them that the leaders of the church had never hidden anything from anybody. And he did this holding the 1832 account of the first vision that Joseph Fielding Smith hid in his safe for 3 decades. And something broke in me at that point, because I now understood that our apostles could just lie. Like, just not by mistake, not misunderstanding stuff. Not all silly old granddads. They intentionally just lie. And he told all of those young people to tell the same lie. If anyone asks any questions about all this church history nonsense, just tell them the leaders of the church never hid anything from anybody. It's all rubbish. The child safeguarding issue came up. Sam Young's Protect LDS Children campaign, by an amazing catalogue of events, I and two others ended up appearing on the Victoria Derbyshire news show in the morning, advocating for his campaign. Brilliant, amazing experience. My first time really being a public vocal voice for reform in our church. They excommunicated him, then made some improvements to safeguarding him, children, but not enough. Then there were the talks, the 3 BYU talks, Elder Eyring Jr. at Idaho, the Renlands at Hawaii, I think it was Corbridge at Provo, manifestos for telling the young people never to question and not to think. That if you have any questions about anything to do with the church, have a guilt trip about your sins, feel better because you repented, you'll know everything's true. Don't even think about it. From Henry B. Eyring Jr., president of BYU Idaho. The Renlands even had an animation mocking people with questions. Elder Corbridge, all these secondary issues don't matter. Just get a spiritual witness the Book of Mormon is true and everything else is true. When it is the secondary issues of Joseph Smith's life, what he did, that we build our testimonies on. And then the conference talks, Elder Eyring, the power of sustaining faith. It is a sin you must repent of to speak or even think of your leaders of having human weakness. And he quoted George Q. Cannon, only God can judge them. In other words, diplomatic immunity for any form of leadership, spiritual priesthood abuse you want. You are not allowed to even think that your leaders are doing anything wrong, which is a catastrophe for child safeguarding or for common sense, really. But he taught that as a principle and said we should go through that process of repenting for that before every worthiness interview and every conference where we'll sustain leaders. President of the 70, F. Whitney Clayton, taught that real obedience is unconditional and in advance, after saying he wasn't teaching about unconditional obedience. Elder Anderson and others, your sustaining vote of the leaders is not them being held accountable to you, as it always was. It is now you making a covenant promise to unconditionally obey and support anything the leaders do or say. Dallin Oaks taught there is no loyal opposition in the church. In other words, you can't disagree with anything they say or do without and consider yourself a faithful and loyal to the gospel of Jesus Christ and the restoration. He then, a few months later, went and spoke to our parliament and lectured them about tolerating diversity and religious freedom. The B1 event to celebrate 40 years since we stopped being racist. And Dallin Oaks got up and began with a grumpy granddad lecture saying, actually, it was God's idea after all to be racist. And he's recently expanded on that at length. His talk to a couple of months ago at Brigham Young University called Racism and Other Challenges, he's expanded on that and absolutely doubled down that that it was always God's commandment to be racist. But we can't call it racism because it's God. So you can't call God a racist. So whatever he did and the church did isn't racism, even though it was racist segregation. That talk is extraordinary. It begins with him preaching powerfully against discrimination, but then by the end, that's just us, but you can't criticize the church. And that's all because he cannot allow himself to acknowledge that the leaders could ever make a mistake. So he's going that extreme to defend that position. So I'm now experiencing leaders of the church literally teaching Lucifer's plan of salvation, as I've always been taught it. You obey, you don't think for yourself, you're not allowed to question. We will do your thinking for you. And there is no exceptions allowed. Lockstep, everyone. So what do you do? Well, a lot of people leave. My friends started leaving. They were just fed up with the lies, with the cultural damage, with the judgmentalism, the shaming, all of these things that cause people to lose their testimonies. I was able to hang in there a bit long, or still hang in there, because in a sense I'd grown up with this ability to differentiate between the leaders and what they're doing and what the real religion is. But I've realized I can't just ignore this anymore. And what has accelerated things is we are now at a very specific point of crisis. The stats were leaked recently for activity rates in Britain, which are usually highly secret. In the 10 years since the Area Presidency of Europe challenged Europe to double sacrament attendance, it has plummeted. We are down to now 15% on average, less than 15% of the Latter-day Saints on the records in Britain and Ireland active in the church. And it's similar across Europe and many other areas. We have the revelations that the church has been hoarding unbelievable wealth, investing our tithing in the stock market, using none of it to help the church. Over $100 billion in just the Ensign Peak Fund, which they kept so secret that most of the apostles didn't know about it. Boyd K. Packer, as president of the 12, asked how much money is in this fund, and he was told by the First Presidency and the presiding bishopric who manage it that he was not allowed to know. Of course, they weren't feeling guilty, I'm sure, which changes everything regarding tithing. They can, just on the interest from that one fund, they can cover the entire budget of the church and have $2 billion left over to spend on more things or reinvest. And this just understanding the leaders are not going to change by themselves. We keep hoping that a younger generation will come through, that there'll be baby steps. But what has actually happened is this particular version of Mormonism, which I call Pharisee Mormonism, has become the dominant mindset. It is the religion of the First Presidency now, and they teach it. Everything about what I was raised to do and be is the opposite of what they are now teaching is the faithful path, the covenant path. And it harms so many people, and it's so elitist. It only works for a tiny percentage of people to marry in the temple, have all of their children marry the right people in the temple, all stay fully active unto the fourth generation. Like, hardly anyone even manages that. But that's all they talk about now as a path for righteousness. The definition of Christianity, Jesus said, is what do you do and what do you say for the outcasts? How do you support the people on the fringes, the people for whom the easy life does not come easily? That is the definition of your Christianity. And we live in a culture that only wants to talk about the stereotype ideal, and everyone else is kind of something embarrassing you mention in private. And that's been an intentional pathway that Boyd K. Packer asked the leaders of the church to follow. When really it should be the reverse. Our whole religion should be about how do we treat the LGBTQ people. There are people in local areas pioneering doing this right. My stake is doing amazing things for child safeguarding, for LGBTQ inclusion, and some of our neighbouring stakes are as well. We can bring about change by initiating things locally and then having that spread. But the problem as I see it, and why I've started doing these podcasts and being much more intensely critical and vocal, is that that's not enough anymore and we have no time left. The church will cease to exist in Britain in the next 15 or 20 years. And a lot of us have already passed the point of losing too many of our young people to survive as a congregation once the elderly die. The church's own stats from years ago was that 80% of our young people leave the church by the time they're 30. And it's a higher percentage now. So every person I look at church, I kind of see now as a dead testimony walking. At some point, they or their children are going to uncover all of this knowledge on the internet, which is always just a click away, about these corruptions, about the problems, about how much we've been lied to about our history. And so you can't, my view, and the view that Elder Ballard talked when he said to everyone years ago to follow, is we've got to inoculate people. They need to hear it first from us at church, and we need to help people to process that. And we still haven't done that in pretty much every way. What's the strategy? The Blogonacle is a brains trust. Talk to the people who left. They'll tell you how to fix the church. They'll tell you why they had to go, why they could have stayed, and what that would take. And that's what I'm trying to communicate with these podcasts particularly. We can reform the whole worthiness culture. Young people want community and purpose. We can offer them community, we can offer them purpose, but they are not going to touch with a barge pole an organization that is anyway sexist, racist, or homophobic and transphobic. And if our church is the last organization on earth in their lives tolerating or practicing those things, they are not going to stay in our church. And that is the ultimate reality we all have to face. We are going to have to ordain women. We are going to have LGBTQ equality. It'll be painful and difficult, but there is no other way. And we just have to get on with working towards that. But Dallin Oaks has a plan. He's the next prophet. He's already laid out his plan to fight all of those things intensively. So whether we like it or not, if we're going to keep our children in this church, we have to engage in this struggle for the soul of our religion. We have to engage in the civil war. We need to take back power. The scriptures give us the common consent authority to authorize and screen anything the leaders present or declare as a revelation. But they are fighting back. They've added disagreeing with policies of the church to adding to disagreeing with doctrine as a definition of apostasy in the new handbook, which also threw in for good measure that we should all take the sacrament with our right hands. So we are not in neutral territory anymore. We are not slowly progressing as a church. That's not happening. We were for a bit, but we need to understand that the clear plan, clearly communicated, of our current senior leadership is to go back to the future and to undo most of that progress. So whether you like it or not, you are going to have to at some point engage in this civil war. And this is what I'm trying to do. It comes at a cost. It upsets people. It means I may well be excommunicated. I hope I'm not. But that is, of course, a clear and present danger. But I've had to make peace with that in order to do what I feel, for me at least, is the right thing to do to begin this conversation, or it's not to begin, it's been going on for ages, to contribute to it, to encourage us to start having these conversations, because I can't stand anymore watching another family leave the church when they don't need to, when they're leaving because of the things the church taught them. They're leaving not in rebellion against the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or the Book of Mormon or the scriptures or the principles of our religion. They're leaving because those same principles are being violated egregiously, shamelessly, relentlessly, and they cannot stay with integrity. And that is the tragic reality that we all have to face up to fast. And we need to deserve to have them back and to keep them. The problem is with us. It is not the world attacking us. We've done this to ourselves. And I'm creating a space for the fact that there's so much good in our religion. We have Christian Mormonism, wonderful. But all the time it's being battered and often defeated by the Pharisee religion that unfortunately is very much in the ascendancy. So that's my kind of big picture analysis. That's where I'm at. That is what I'm challenging people to consider engaging with. And we'll see how it goes. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it. We'll be happy to take questions.
I'll read it exactly as it is, as it's been put by the author. It says, Peter talked about a past church which was exciting and full of possibilities. What does he think are the possibilities for the future in the UK so that we can regain that excitement?
We have a religion that should be absolutely winning the 21st century. But because of the intense, often by highly uneducated people, Pharisee focus on not engaging with the modern world, we've ended up with a religion that's hostile to science, that has all these issues. But original Mormonism has scriptures about learning from the best books about everything. It is totally pro-education. It is all about embracing what we can learn from science, from other religions. Even Brigham Young, some amazing quotes about absorbing all knowledge into our religion, that we should be a sponge, that we should, you know, so just having that mindset of being able to connect with other people, learn from them, as well as sharing what we have. So that mental attitude should be much more open and hopeful rather than scared of the world. We should be the most feminist Christians walking the earth today. We have a female God, for goodness sake. Eve is the hero of the Garden of Eden, according to actually Genesis, but also the endowment and Mormon scriptures. She is the first avatar of Christ. She chose to become mortal in order to save and exalt mankind. She chose to seek knowledge over comfort, whatever, even if it would kill her, which is powerful. She was decisive. She took action. These are all attributes usually associated with men in our culture, being a dynamic leader, an innovator, an actor. She is our hero. The history of the Christian world's and, you know, Judeo-Christian Islamic world's biblical based hostility to women has been based on how she was presented traditionally in the Garden of Eden story, and representing all women being weak, temptresses, and dangerous, and not able to be responsible with power. Mormonism flipped that script entirely by saying that the fall was a fall upwards, a conscious choice, and it was made by a woman. We should be the most feminist religion ever. And the fact that we're one of the least feminist Christians groups at the moment is just shameful, but we can turn that around. The Book of Mormon is often seen as racist because it established at the beginning a kind of a divine curse of based on dark skin. But keep reading. The Book of Mormon is an anti-racist polemic. The brown people win. The white supremacists totally destroy themselves. They lose all credibility because of their hatred, and they lose their souls and they lose their civilization. And ultimately, it's a powerful anti-white supremacist book. It's the brown people who inherit the covenants. So all of these kind of key social issues of the modern age, we should be all over that, not being the last to catch up, which is the usual. And our leaders are still that backward because they completely conflate being backward-looking, socially conservative, white American old men with God's will and how God sees everything. And our scriptures are the opposite, so we need to free ourselves from that nonsense. We have our scriptures say that actually there's a little verse in the Book of Mormon that God has spoken to every nation, kindred, and tongue, including the non-Israelites. It says, you know, the children of Israel, wherever they've scattered, but also the rest. So technically, we can engage with all the other religions and their scriptures and what we can learn from them. The Book of Mormon says that, and the Book of Mormon's message is one of global inclusion. It's not just about this one little tribe in the Middle East that matters to God. Well, there's so much multicultural, global vision there as fundamental principles in our religion. We are not meant to be parochial and stuck in the mountains somewhere. I think in Britain, I'm trying to, in a way, embody the best of British revolution. We're Bolshe. We don't suffer fools gladly. If our political leaders get a bit above themselves or talk rubbish, we will turn on them like that. They're gone. There's no, you know, we'll criticize them. We'll tell it how it is. We'll swear about them in the pub. The only reason our monarchy has survived is they've learnt to not show off, even though it looks like they're showing off. They have to like be super humble. And our thought about them has to be, oh, they're really working hard and serving us, even when the cameras are off and someone's bringing them a champagne. And I think the part of the reason we've tolerated such a terrible behavior from our general authorities and arrogance for so long, unquestioned, unchallenged, is both that culture of deference within the church, but I think it is also an American culture. There's a real kind of bamboozlement about people who are powerful and rich that kind of that is respected. American culture is about you can show off if you're successful or in charge, and other people will respect you for that. Like, oh, well done being successful. In Britain, it's like, no, shut up, stop getting over yourself. Who do you think you are? And I think just that instinct to not put up with rubbish, not put up with pompous, arrogant people who actually don't know what they're talking about or are contradicting themselves or are talking nonsense. We have that streak within us to be like, no, you're not impressing me right now. Are you kidding? And ultimately, if we are in a sense going to topple an oligarchy, which is what this is about in however way we do it, whether just as in our heads declare independence and hold on to our religion, regardless of how the leaders behave when they're behaving badly, we've got the rebel streak to do it, you know, just in how Britons react to people with authority and power. And we've learned to really care about our religion. We don't slip into it easily here. You have to really want to be Mormon if you're going to be Mormon. And we're also, we get a lot of experience. The church internationally, where you haven't got huge wards, everyone gets to serve in leadership callings that are significant. And there's a real sort of loss of that experience in the large Utah wards, where people don't get that experience and they feel their talents are being wasted, and they are. So I think maybe the model of how we experience church could be something we could offer the American heartlands. Maybe they need to have small awards where everyone does get to do something significant rather than just be bums on seats, because that has made our people much stronger in lots of ways. One more thing. My mantra is Dieter Uchtdorf's talk. It works wonderfully. It was given in 2015 before they demoted him for it. And he said in that he gets it. You know, I'm not making this up. He said, we have a problem in our church. We have created a mountain of sediments, you know, the metaphor he used, of man-made good ideas, you know, things that seem to be a good idea. Let's do that. Programs, good expectations of our members. But when we should have then got rid of them, we didn't. We've piled them up. Every member of the church is carrying around this huge burden of all the thousand things you didn't do today that you should have done to be a good Mormon. You didn't study the scriptures long enough. You didn't write your journal. You didn't sort your food storage out. You didn't do your home teaching. You didn't phone that person. You aren't developing your talents. You haven't. And he said it's crushing the flower of the gospel, the real gospel. So he got up there and he said it. He said, we have a Pharisee problem. The Pharisees add rules and rules and rules and expectations to control you and try to make you good. And it doesn't work. You have to trust people to govern themselves. And he pleaded with the leaders of the church to take these burdens off and to stop adding to them. But the leadership of the church has decided to go with adding more burdens. We're now meant to take the sacrament with our right hands. You can't even oppose a policy or you're an apostate. Burden, burden, burden. If we can flip that script again, there's so much hope. We can just unburden ourselves of this weight that we're all carrying around.
Just lost it. Okay, here we go. As a UK church attending Latter-day Saints who loves the church and wants to see it thrive, I see you as someone trying to build the church up. Do you ever feel your intentions in speaking about the issues you do are misunderstood by some church members? What would you say is your motivation for speaking out as you do?
My nieces, my nephew, my cousins, my generation have lost most of our kids. Our parents' generation have lost most of their kids. I do not want it to happen to the next generation. And there isn't going to be much generation because most of them have already gone to even have those kids. That is it. We cannot keep repeating the same mistake. And it means upsetting people. It means them thinking I'm an apostate, heretic, apostate. How dare I criticize the leaders? That's like criticizing God. Because they're, you know, in most people's minds in the church who are still active, there's no differentiation. But also the inevitability of the doom. I go and visit wards or meet up with people my age or my parents' age who I've known for years all my life. And a lot of these old faithfuls are still there. It's incredible. And I say, how are you doing? And it's the same conversation. How are you doing? Oh, I'm doing fine or good. How are your children? You know, the people I grew up with. Oh, they're amazing. They're doing so well. They've married well. Their kids are incredible. They're doing really well in their careers. They don't come to church anymore. They don't come to church anymore. It's apocalypse. And they're shell-shocked because they were all promised. They were promised since the 1960s and 70s. If you serve in your callings and leave your family for hours every week, if you do family home evening, if you do your scripture study, if you get your temple recommend and keep it, they were promised you will have this progeny in the church. You will get the joy of seeing your children grow up in the gospel and you'll be with them in heaven and your grandchildren. And that, for in nearly every case, that is gone or it's about to go. And we're about to do it to the third generation. I can't stand it. I cannot stand it. We can't just not say or do anything different because it's too late anyway, almost in most congregations. The kids have already gone, but there's no time left. These changes have to come fast. They need to be now. People do need to be shocked out of their complacency. So I've chosen to be the fall guy to do that in my situation as best I see it, which can sound arrogant, but it was the church that taught me to be a savior in Mount Zion of everyone. So it's, if I have a Messiah complex, it's because I'm a Mormon, you know, and we all do. We all have this responsibility not to just sleepwalk into over a cliff, which is what is mostly happening. So that's why I'm shaking it up.
Okay, yeah. I think this next question follows on quite well from that. This is a question and a statement, really. It says, why is it so hard for us to talk about these things in our LDS congregations? It feels as though the church would prefer that anyone with questions just leave quietly and never come back, rather than stay and ever mention anything that could be perceived as remotely critical.
Because that is exactly what the leaders want. That's why. That's what they teach. That's what they value. And they demonize literally anything else. And everyone's been trained with a script. If someone says something that makes you uncomfortable, that's challenging your paradigm, they're saying, well, actually, that isn't true. That thing about our church history is not accurate. And they've been telling you this since the Gospel Topics essays were published in 2013. Why have you not read them? Why am I being punished and shamed in gospel doctrine for knowing the stuff you were meant to have read 10 years ago and that the leaders were told to get you educated about? But they haven't. They've been scared. And it's all down to leadership. They've been very specifically encouraged not to do that. And the curriculum for the adults is still mostly ignoring that new history. They're doing better at teaching to the kids, but it's still very, very clear that they do not want the adults to find out how much they were lied to. And instead of providing a pastoral pathway to cope with that, to face up to that truth, because we were lied to a lot, but still they're choosing the lies. It's cowardice, cowardice, cowardice. They keep chickening out of actually doing the thing that needs doing. And this was shown again just in the last conference. Our history of racism is meant to be their big theme at the moment, rooting out racism from the church. They're trying to impress the NAACP, who they've kind of formed a tentative alliance with. But Elder Cook got up and he taught a version of our history that completely erased our racist history. He said that when the Mormons went to Utah, it was all sweetness and light because our scriptures tell us not to be racist. And he quoted one random example of a family being nice to Indians and just talked about harmony. The reality is when they arrived there, they had slaves with them. Brigham Young, when the Utah Territory was created, gave a massive speech at the Utah legislature saying, we will be a slave state, which they didn't need to be. You know, slavery will be legal in our state because it's God's will. And he went on to say that interracial marriage was so appalling that anyone who married interracially should both be beheaded and their children. Their heads should be cut off. And that was in 1852 when he absolutely finalized, we are not ever going to ordain black people until every white person at the end during the millennium has had the opportunity to have the priesthood first. And black men and women will not set foot in our temple. And even though black people had already been ordained up to that point. That was the real history. And Utah was racially segregated until well into the civil rights era. They massacred Native Americans. At times they were nice to them, but there were massacres of the Timpanogos and Indians by Mormons, which killed hundreds. They literally enslaved Native American people. The Mormons did, enslaved men, women, and children, hundreds of them, if you learn the real history of Utah. And they tried to blame them for the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And then they did the Indian Placement Program, and President Kimball promised that their children's skin would turn white and the Lamanite curse would be lifted. If you go and look at Elder Cook's talk, October 29th, 2020, none of it. So that is just a very clear signal that these people at the top are not going to change. And they're actually now reversing, they're backtracking from the Gospel Topics essays. The trajectory is in reverse, assertively. So they are not going in the right direction to save our church. We are going to have to challenge them to stop lying.
That's great. It's really interesting. I think because we are, we're brought up to, and in Sunday school and priesthood and everything else to answer with these kind of set cliche answers of read your scriptures, say your prayers. It's very easy for us to detect as soon as somebody kind of goes off the script, you know, and those alarm bells go off. Yeah.
And what happens is we kid adults that they're learning. We keep repeating this curriculum. We scroll through the scriptures. the same questions get asked, the same answers are given, and that's it. Everyone knows the script. And there's been no actual learning for years and years, unless you have a particularly good teacher who's willing to go off the manual and actually teach. And there's an intentional dumbing down now of the curriculum. The Come Follow Me curriculum has been reduced to the child level of depth. It's about proof texting. It is no longer, here are the scriptures, let's expose ourselves to everything they offer, we might learn something new. Everything is framed as, these are the three things the general authority has decided it's safe for you to know about these passages. And they often leave out the juicy bits, you know, again, completely ignoring polygamy most of the time and such like that. And so it's, again, then it's an intentional infantilization. And I try to understand the people who are locked into it, this feedback loop. And it is, it's just soothing. It's comforting. The people who that supports are the people who just in a crazy difficult world want to go and have a bit of peace of quiet at church. They want to hear the same rhythms. It's a bit like the Catholics, you know, they want to hear the Latin Mass, just the sounds of their childhood echoing around, be reassured that everything is fine. Everything's very simple, easy answers to stuff. We know it. It's just to get that sort of, it's like, you know, a meditation or something, but they're not being educated. They're not to learn something. You have to have your previous assumptions challenged, and you have to learn something you didn't know before. That's education. And so grown adults are kept trapped in elementary level knowledge because it's psychologically soothing. But ultimately, these people are not the growth of the church. They're not great missionaries. They just want to repeat the rituals. And the thing that really aggravates me is we watched the Church of England do this to itself. My child, you know, the C of E throughout my childhood was still kind of quite dominant in society. They had big congregations, but over and over again, they made the choice not to modernize, not to be relevant to their young people, but to always pander to the older generation who were reliable and would turn up and do the flowers and pay the dues. So they got to always have their way. The young people left, then the old people died, empty church. The Church of England has been decimated. Their average attendance at church now is 27. The average C of E, and after COVID, that's expected to be annihilated. You know, there's newspaper articles about that now. And I watched them do that throughout my childhood. Like, we must never do that. Thank goodness we'll never do that. We're doing it. And Richard Bushman, who wrote Rough Stone Rolling, famously said in a fireside, describing this process, he said, the leaders of the church have chosen to prioritize the grandmothers of San Pete County, which is sort of in southern Utah somewhere, over their grandchildren. And that is a strategy with an extremely short time limit, because when they're dead, so is your ward, they're gone. So we have to break this. And ultimately, ward and state leaders are going to have to step up and do what they were told to do 7 years ago and teach their people the gospel topics essays and make that central. Because I've had bruising experiences over the last few weeks in Sunday school lessons where I've been trying to teach the actual history or introduce some of it, and not even the difficult stuff. Like, seriously, they have no idea how much I'm holding back, in a sense. And it has gone down like a lead balloon and upset people. And we can't keep doing this to our members. We can't keep punishing the people who do due diligence. We can't keep punishing the people who are speaking the truth. They can't be the ones who have to hang their heads in shame. It's suicidal. So ultimately, leaders are going to have to step up and make that change happen, because it's not happening by itself. What happens is the people who try that just get fed up. They can't, it's painful to attend any lesson, so they stop going, because it's just too awful. It's like walking on glass, and we've got to stop doing that to people.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. The next question is a statement, not a question, but it links on really well with what you've been saying there. It just says, it would be a travesty if you were to be excommunicated.
And what I'd say to people sitting in the High Council around the table, if I was, you know, on trial in a court of love, First of all, I'd say, well, how many of your kids are still active then? Why is it that you think what I'm saying is a threat to their testimony when everything you and the entire church and all the prophets and apostles have done and said to those kids has not kept them? You think I'm the problem, you know, first of all. And then it will be the way, you know, look at the stats. All the states in our area lost 1 in 4 of their active members over the last 10 years. You only need to have that happen one more time and you will not be able to come back, because what you lose is the kids who would then have the children, the kids who would be the missionaries. We are now already, we've had our mission closed down. The England, London, South mission is gone because there's not enough workforce. The mission I served in, the Florida Tallahassee mission, has closed, but they'll build a temple there. They've announced a temple for Tallahassee, closed the mission, and bought 2% of Florida as a commercial investment.
Thank you. Okay, next, Rob, this is the question, what do you love most about the LDS Church / Mormon doctrine?
I'd say what I love about the church is our, one of our amazing unique selling points is we involve everyone in ministry. I think this is incredible. We had an open house during a sort of interfaith open house week a couple of years ago, and I was chatting to a Sikh lady, I think, and just talking about what we do as a church and how we organize ourselves. And this is something I really picked up in all my interactions with other Christians in the Bible Belt and also through Christian Union, that we rock. They just waste their people and their talents. You know, they'll pay a few people to be the ministering team, or those people will volunteer. They get to have all these interesting, growing leadership role experiences and minister. And the people just turn up and worship every week, and that's kind of it. And there's not much more. Such a waste, ridiculous waste of all that talent. And Mormonism uses it. If you can breathe and you're willing, you've got a calling. And particularly where, as we experience in Britain, where we're not overrun with people, everyone gets to have an interesting calling. You know, I've done nearly all of them except the scary ones. So I'll wear a yellow jacket if it looks like I might be a bishop at some point, which I don't think is going to happen now. That's basically what this is all about. It's making sure I'm never going to be a bishop. But my brother is now, bless him. So that is like the amazing thing our church does. As part of this idea, we've all got the potential to become gods, for goodness sake. So start training people up. As far as doctrine goes, I've already mentioned several. We have a Heavenly Mother, Eve is a hero. We have an anti-racist scripture that's specifically designed for our age and we should be rocking the world with, but we can never do that until our leaders apologize for the racism and stop pretending it didn't happen, like they just did in October General Conference. It's unbelievable. Idiots. And then I don't know, so much the idea that our potential is to become gods. I cannot deal with a god who would not want his actual children to be everything that he is. I mean, this is fundamental. If you're a parent, you don't just want your kids to become everything you are. You want them to become more. Like, what kind of a sick sadist makes children to just keep them like an ant farm and torture half of them? That's ridiculous. And this is something I really sort of encountered conceptually at college. Don't know where my book is. Here it is. Crisis of Moral Authority. So I had a job at university, which had a load of RE students there, stacking shelves in the library. And I came across this book by Don Cupit called Crisis of Moral Authority, who is a Cambridge theologian from the 60s. And he was one of these sort of revolutionary forward thinkers. And he basically dismantles the traditional Christian God, specifically the point that if God made everyone out of nothing, ex nihilo, God is ethically responsible for all of us, for our mistakes, for our sins, for the people who end up in hell. He's a sick sadist. He made people in order, knowing that one day he'd be throwing them around in vats of lava in outer darkness or whatever. And that destroys, in one swoop, destroys the traditional Christian God. They have no comeback from that. because of their idea that God has to predate the existence of his creations. And I was like, oh my gosh, this weird thing Joseph Smith taught that kind of didn't make much sense, that we are co-eternal with God, that somehow whatever our spirit or intelligence or life spark is, has just always been there. He didn't make it. There is no individual personal God responsible for that existence, because God is a career. It's not, he, you know, there were gods before, or the universe, you know, that's just the way it is. That absolves God of that fundamental ethical responsibility for all of our sins and everything that's wrong in the world. We have the answer. It's still a bit weird. It's philosophical. You know, you have to kind of get your head around a few concepts. But we do in our theology. It's not all like, oh, Joseph Smith just plagiarized from the people around him. No, there is so much more to what he taught that goes far deeper, that we can rock the 21st century with, that we can win theological debates, you know. So I love that. This is why I'm a passionate Latter-day Saint. I'm not going to go and be another kind of Christian. They're really messed up. Their God's a sadist. I mean, my gosh, you know, I've seen what those people do or say. I mean, I know that sounds arrogant, and that's not how all other Christians feel. But, you know, in big picture nutshell, this is, for me, this is where the big ideas are at. But we're absolutely underselling them, and our leaders do not care. They don't even understand half of this doctrine. And Hugh Nibley warned us that this would happen in his famous speech to BYU leaders versus managers in the early 80s, I think. He said, you know, and he saw it coming, if you let the manager class take over the church, they will infiltrate everything and you will cease to flourish, just like happened to the Roman Empire. He said they're the lawyers, they're the business managers, and they care most about money. What have we got today? Most of our apostles have trained, nearly all the apostles, even Uchtdorf, trained in business management. They're not, and what they're not is they're not literature students. They're not theology students. The stuff of religion is history, is culture, is the arts, is literature, which I think is why people like Patrick Mason and Terrell Givens have really struck a positive sort of vibe with Latter-day Saints, because they bring to their reconfiguration of Mormonism, and they are quite radically reconfiguring it, that they bring that insight from history and culture and religion. They understand religion. That needs to come back as well. We need to rediscover our actual theology and religion and love it and celebrate it. And that's kind of the strength that we can feed ourselves with. But what we're being fed is thin gruel, Sunday after Sunday, and each year the curriculum dumbs down further. It does not get more sophisticated by a long way. I mean, we had, you know, some amazing, sparky, intensely ideological young single adults who were nurtured by an amazing missionary couple, giving them lots of time and investing and having these interesting conversations about Mormon theology with them that just switched them on, like I was at their age. They're gone. It's just boring.
So the question that I've got here then is, why exactly would Mormons who left come back? Would they need a new agenda and formally present it?
Every time I do a presentation about the great things about Mormonism, theologically, the community we can offer when we're doing it right, they say to me afterwards, you've just reminded me why I love this religion. You know, they feel that pull. It's like a magnet, because they loved that. They were living it. They're not aliens. They've been Mormon. They understand it all. We have to deserve to have our children stay. We have to deserve the less active to return. And we don't deserve it. We have tolerated corruption on an epic scale. We have normalized Lucifer's plan of salvation through unthinking, unconditional obedience to very flawed human leaders to become our religion that gets taught in General Conference. I mean, that we're not offering the Church of Jesus Christ to come back to. They've taken it with them. Their integrity to the values of the restoration of Christianity, of the return of the fullness of the gospel. They had to take it with them and leave because it wasn't safe on a pew in a Mormon chapel. That's insane. But that is what's happened. And we just have to recognize that, repent, make radical reforms, and then beg them to return and prove to them that we've repented and changed. Yeah,
fantastic.
Thank you so much, everyone. I really appreciate your patience and time, and I hope some of that was helpful. And ultimately, while being, you know, how I was raised in the church, critical analysis, we can do better, but love it. This religion's amazing. We're here to be a world religion, but we can't do it this way. It's not happening. So let's get back to being a world religion again. We can do this.